This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thomas Sowell is one of the most influential economists, syndicated columnists, and social critics of the past half century, having authored provocative best-selling books on everything from race relations to childhood development to, most recently, charter schools and their enemies. His masterworks include Knowledge and Decisions, which uses Friedrich Hayek's insights about distributed information to explain both how markets work and why intellectuals disdain markets. A Conflict of Visions, which explores the ideological origins of political struggles. And Basic Economics, a best-selling primer now in its fifth edition. Sowell's life is as inspiring as his work is expansive. He was born black and poor in North Carolina in 1930 and received his PhD from the University of Chicago at the age of 38. Both his work and life are now the subjects of a new documentary, Common Sense in a Senseless World, and a forthcoming biography titled Maverick. For today's Reason Interview podcast, I speak with Jason L. Riley. He's the author of the film and the biography, and he tells me why, even at age 90, Sowell is more relevant today than ever. A fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Riley tells me that Sowell's empirically driven research and his fearless engagement with even the most controversial topics are exactly what our world needs more of. Here is the Reason Interview with Jason Riley. Jason Riley, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
Let's start with a quick summary, a kind of elevator pitch of the book and the documentary. Why is Thomas Sowell relevant now?
Well, we're still talking about income inequality in this country and affirmative action and social justice and issues like that. And these are topics that Thomas Sowell has spent a professional lifetime writing about. So I think he still has a lot to say to current generation and future generations on these subjects. These are matters that are far from settled.
Yeah. You know, the title of the book is Maverick. What is the essence of Sowell's maverickness?
Well, it takes on a lot of forms, but he's someone who has been something of an intellectual loner throughout his career, someone who has bucked convention, not particularly concerned himself with being popular, but concerned himself with being a truth teller, being a straight shooter. And unfortunately, and maybe this is a commentary on intellectuals today, is that makes him a maverick, someone who puts truth above popularity, who doesn't concern himself with being politically correct and being fashionable in his thinking and so forth. He follows the facts where they lead, whether or not the conclusion is a popular one. And unfortunately today, that makes you something of a maverick.
Can you sketch a quick biography of Thomas Sowell? When was he born? Where was he born? And where did he end up?
Well, he was born in 1930 in Gastonia, North Carolina, which is just outside of Charlotte. And he was orphaned at a very young age. His father died actually before he was born. And his mother died giving birth to a younger brother of Tom. So Tom was taken in by a great aunt and her two grown daughters. And they moved first to Charlotte and then to Harlem, where he was about 8 or 9 years old. And that's where he was raised, essentially. One of the daughters subsequently got married and the husband lived with the family. So Tom was essentially raised as an only child with four adults around. And he sort of credited that with a lot of good things that have happened to him throughout his lifetime. He had a pretty tumultuous home life otherwise, however, particularly when he found out that that he had been adopted. This is something that had been hidden from him, from his great aunt, and it caused quite a bit of turmoil when he was a young man and learned of this. He ends up leaving home, dropping out of high school. He never received a high school degree. He later earned his GED and sort of wandered around for a little while, was drafted into the Marines during the Korean War, spent 2 years in the Marines, got out, and then he enrolled in night school at Howard University, the historically black college in Washington, and then he transferred to Harvard, where he earned his undergraduate degree at age 28. He was 28 years old before he got a bachelor's, which is pretty remarkable. You realize how late a start he got and how prolific he's been notwithstanding that late start.
He didn't get his PhD until he was 38, right?
It was 1968. So yes, he moved from Harvard to Columbia to get his master's in economics, and he intended to study under George Stigler at Columbia, but Stigler left Columbia for the University of Chicago, and so Tom followed him there the next year and ended up completing his PhD at Chicago under both Stigler and Milton Friedman, who was already at Chicago. And he received his PhD in 1968. He had spent the 60s in academia, teaching at a number of schools. And then in the 70s, he started to branch out a little more. I think he was at Cornell in 1969 when there was all that turmoil on campus. And I think that really soured him a bit on the teaching profession, on what was going on in academia at the time. And he would spend the 70s continuing to teach, but I think he sort of had one foot out the door, and he eventually settled at the Hoover Institution in 1980, and he's been there ever since.
He did not have a lot of respect for either Harvard or Columbia, as you talk about it in the book. What was his beef with
those institutions? And still doesn't, might add. I think it's part of a couple things were going on there. I think he was much older than the average student, obviously. He'd been living on his own for some time. He'd been in the Marines. And I think he didn't have much patience for sort of undergraduate behavior that most undergraduates tolerate because they're of such an age that is tolerable. Tom has always been a more serious person, and I think the age gap sort of exacerbated things there. But I think more broadly, it was part of his problem with intellectuals and their self-regard in society. And even back then, Tom was an empiricist, and he had little use for fancy talk. And that's what he saw those schools as full of, blowhards, essentially. And I think that grated on him somewhat.
You write in the book, and I think, you know, he has more or less said the same thing as well, you know, that his approach to things was really kind of formalized at University of Chicago. Could you talk a little bit? I want to talk about his specific insights, but what is his general method, and why does that, you know, kind of set him apart from other economists and social theorists?
Well, I think that Tom would probably argue that he was thinking like a Chicago school economist before he got there. And there's probably some evidence of that. I get into that in the book when he published a book of correspondence back in the mid-2000s. And it turns out that Tom was quite the prolific letter writer back in the 1950s and 60s, or from that time period. And you can see in these personal letters, and he kept carbons even of letters that he wrote and sent to other people, which I find incredible.
Right. It's a little disturbing, but it's good that we have.
But that's
them,
what he did. So he published these letters. And when you look at letters he was writing back in the 60s, early 60s in particular, and this again is you know, he was thinking like a Chicago economist way back then. But essentially, it's an adherence to empiricism, to facts and logic, and putting that ahead of theory. Tom is much more interested in how an idea has panned out, what the evidence is for success or failure, rather than simply what the intent is. And I think that is what distinguishes him and much of the Chicago school from their counterparts at MIT or Harvard or other places, where there was much more of an emphasis, at least in the field of economics, on elegant theories and mathematics. And that is not the type of economist that Thomas Sowell was, or other people at Chicago associated with that school, from a Gary Becker, Robert Lucas, and those types.
You know, one of the examples that comes up in a discussion of, you know, where that methodology leads him has to do with the unemployment rate for Black teenagers. You know, the intention, or, you know, the stated intention of raising minimum wage laws is essentially that it will help poor people earn more money. When Sowell looked at the effects on Black teenagers, what did he find, and how does that kind of exemplify, you know, how he approaches things?
Well, it's interesting because Tom entered Chicago as a Marxist and left as a Marxist. he was not only on the left in his youth; he was on the far left, and it was really not the tutelage of Stigler or Friedman that turned him into a free market adherent. It was a job in the government in the early 1960s, working for the Department of Labor, where
that was like a summer internship,
yes,
right, or something. So it was like he went to school for 20 years, but it only took 3 months in the government.
He was studying the impact of the minimum wage in Puerto Rico, and that's when he sort of saw the light on the intent of the policy versus the ramifications of the policy. And Tom, again, is someone who liked to follow the facts. And he realized that these government programs didn't have, the government had its own agenda, so to speak, and that these policies served the purposes of government, even if they didn't serve the purposes of the intended beneficiaries. And Tom would go on to make that distinction in any number of policy areas.
And I guess that is also paralleling another product of Chicago, and also a person who taught Sowell, James Buchanan. I mean, you see in a lot of his work a kind of innate public choice, or politics without romance, where whatever the stated goals or intentions of the policy are, the important thing is to look at how they actually play out.
Right. I'm not sure if Buchanan was a teacher of Tom's. Mm-hmm. He was a mentor to Walter Williams out at UCLA,
right,
when Williams.
Oh, you know what? I hesitate for confusing the two.
Studied under. I'm not sure. Yeah. Buchanan was one of Tom's professors.
But he was a colleague at UCLA, I guess.
Yes, that sounds right. Yeah, they would have been at UCLA.
So one of Sowell's earliest books is from 1972, Black Education: Myths and Tragedies. What did he find there? And we'll go through some, I want to go through a couple of his books that I find particularly interesting and I think timely, but Black Education, Myths and Tragedies.
Well, it's a semi-autobiographical work. So the first part of it is about his upbringing, attending segregated schools, both grade schools, elementary schools, and integrated schools up north, and then attending a Black college, Howard, and then teaching at a Black college. He taught at Howard for a while and then went on to teach at various other places during the 1960s, including, as I mentioned before, Cornell. And the book sort of grew out of that experience at Cornell. He wrote a long piece for the New York Times Magazine about teaching. And when a publisher saw it, they came to him and said, could you expand this into a book? So you get his reflections on the state of particularly college education at the time. And it's interesting because you realize how early Tom was looking at some of the issues that someone like Alan Bloom wouldn't take up until the mid-1980s and Closing of the American Mind. And some of these insights that Bloom made, I found in Sowell's work dating back to the late 60s. And interestingly, Bloom and Sowell were both at Cornell at the same time.
What is the, he talks also in a variety of works, he talks about how and that too much emphasis, particularly when it comes to minorities, whether they're racial, ethnic, or some other subset of people, that the a failure to kind of thrive or prosper is often mostly focused on as a result of the discrimination that they face in a particular community or polity. And he says that, actually it's more often explained by what's going on within that group. In a context of education, he talked a lot about Dunbar High School in D.C., where it's a high school that goes back to the 19th century that had overperformed or had performed better than most white high schools, selective white high schools in Washington. How does that factor into his discussion of, how to help Blacks and other minorities get good educations?
Yeah, that was a pioneering study that he did of Dunbar High School. And it is still to this day quite a fascinating look inside of that school, and really has broader implications, because it's been central to a lot of Sowell's work, this finding. So much has been placed, particularly in the realm of education, on integration. Making sure that Black kids are sitting next to white kids in schools. We went through this with the whole busing debate in the 1970s.
The center of Brown versus Board of Education.
Brown versus Board of Education.
That schools were unequal, that Blacks would not do as well unless they were in an integrated setting.
And what Tom found is that you can go down through history and find high-achieving all-Black schools. And he wants to know why the focus hasn't been on going back and studying these schools and figuring out what they were doing right instead of forcing Black children into white schools where a lot of whites don't want them, and frankly where you know a lot of Blacks don't want to be. You know, busing was never popular with the larger Black society. This was something that Black elites pushed, people at the NAACP and so forth. But when you asked Black parents what they wanted a good school built down the street. They didn't want to put their kid on a bus and ship them out to the suburbs an hour each way every day. That's not what they wanted. And Sowell has done this pioneering study. He did it on Dunbar High School, but then he did a follow-up on other schools nationwide, high schools and grade schools and so forth, and found that these schools existed in all parts of the country down through history. And again, this focus on making sure that Black kids are sitting next to white kids, he would argue has been misplaced from the start. And we see it today again with charter schools. You have people out there opposed to charter schools on the grounds that too many of them are not integrated enough. And regardless of the fact of how the kids are scoring on tests that attend those schools, how their graduation rates are, how many go on to college and complete college, all of that seems secondary to whether or not the racial mix is right in these schools. And Tom has been arguing for decades that that is not where the emphasis should be.
He came from, what you were recounting his biography, and this comes through in the documentary extremely well. He seems like, he was only born in 1930. So, he's not that, that's not that long ago, but he seemed to come from an America, that is like, from 1830 rather than 1930. And he came from a group of people who were generally uneducated, did not go to school for long periods of time and things like that. Yet he is a strong, and has been his entire career, a very strong proponent of school choice in whatever form it can take. And he placed a lot of trust in the parents, or the guardians of people, even poor people who are uneducated. That leads me to I want to ask your a kind of gloss on Knowledge and Decisions, one of his early books, which became very well known, which is a kind of application of a Hayekian understanding of, where does information, where does the most important and actionable information lay in a society? And Hayek and Sowell say, it's distributed throughout society, and that people who are going to feel the effects of a decision should probably be the ones who are most important in making that decision. Can you talk a little bit about how his belief in people making decisions to better their lives plays into a broader book like Knowledge and Decisions?
Sure. So Hayek was one of Tom's professors at the University of Chicago. And Tom took his course on the history of economic thought, which was Tom's specialty when he was working on his PhD. And what he has is his degree in the history of ideas and the history of economic thought. And Hayek was as much a philosopher as he was an economist. And yet Tom has Milton Friedman to thank for this insight into Hayek, because it was Milton Friedman's course on price theory in which Tom was assigned an essay that Hayek had written back in 1946 for an academic publication called The Use of Knowledge in Society. And Tom has recounted many times how he did not understand why this essay was being assigned in a course on price theory, but he read it at the time. And only years later did he come to appreciate the real insight in this essay, and it eventually gave him the spark, the idea for Knowledge and Decisions, which is a book about the importance of disseminating knowledge and how these decision-making units are necessarily decentralized in a society. I mean, Hayek was writing really in opposition to controlled economies, to socialism, where they thought you could put a bunch of smart people in charge and make decisions for the entire society. And Hayek was pushing back against that. He said that no, even some very smart people cannot know the best decisions to make for an entire community. And that instead you need feedback mechanisms from the actual people in these societies. And both Sowell and Hayek thought prices were the best way to find out what people valued, what they did not value, and so forth, the price mechanism. And so that was what knowledge and decisions was about, essentially. These different decision-making units in society that lead to people making decisions. And one of the important ones is the family, the nuclear family, where people learn to make decisions from their parents and other family members. And so to the extent that decision-making is taken out of the hands of ordinary people and placed in the hands of government bureaucrats and politicians and so forth, what you are doing is eliminate, or I should say, increasing the distance between the person who makes the decision and the person who has to suffer the consequences of that decision. And one of the reasons Sowell wrote that book is because he thought that too much decision-making was being put in the hands of government and that we were headed down a bad path by going in this direction. And I think, obviously, he's been borne out by that.
One of his basic insights is, you know, that, you know, information and knowledge is distributed. So is effects of policy. So, you know, the ability to make decisions should also be distributed. Another part of his mindset, which I think is particularly interesting. Well, I know it's particularly interesting to me. I think to a lot of other people. Comes through in books like A Conflict of Visions, which is subtitled Ideological Origins of Political Struggles. Talk about his emphasis on the constrained versus unconstrained vision of kind of politics and policy or of human life in general. What's he talking about there and why is that important?
Well, it's really a book about human nature and the origin, why people hold the political philosophies that they do. And he traces this back more than 200 years, and not only in the U.S., but in Europe as well, to thinkers like William Godwin and Rousseau and Adam Smith and those guys, the whole classical liberal tradition over there. And he says that there's a direct link between what they were saying back then and what's being said today by, or what was said, you know, from everyone from John Rawls on to Ta-Nehisi Coates and Ibram X. Kendi today, that there are direct links in these strains of thought and these strains of thinking about human nature. And he breaks it down into two visions of human nature. And one is the constrained vision or the tragic vision, he has also called it. And these are people who believe that there are limits on human ability. Man is not perfectible. We can want an end to war. We could want an end to racism and prejudice and poverty, but that's unlikely to happen. And so we do better to spend our time putting in place institutions that reflect these limitations and allow us to make the proper trade-offs. So you could be talking about a military defense. You could be talking about free and fair elections. You can be talking about property rights. But these are things that help us deal with our imperfect nature. And these institutions, it's important to get these institutions right because the utopia is not right around the corner. And then he compares that view with the unconstrained vision, or the utopian vision, which sees anything as possible. There are no trade-offs. Everybody can have everything if we just get it right, and that we can get it right if we keep at it. And when you think that way, it leads you down the path towards a whole different set of policy recommendations and desires for what you want out of government and out of politics and politicians and bureaucrats and so forth. And so he traces the traditions of both of those lines of thought in that book. It's one of he considers it his most important work and it's favorite among his many books.
How does the constrained vision, which I think, you know, broadly, you know, a kind of reason style libertarianism, you know, weirdly dabbles in both. I mean, there's a kind of utopia, techno-utopian, the idea that we can get rid of world hunger. Everybody might not be eating what they want, but we can produce enough food, we can get it distributed properly and all of that. But there's also a real belief in the constrained vision, which is that societies are not perfectible. And who is it? The the open society and its enemies, Karl Popper. Oh. Saying, you know, that people who try to, you know, create heaven on earth inevitably create hell on earth. I mean, there's a, you know, that's a short statement of a constrained vision. How does the constrained vision not just kind of die or, you know, kind of settle into political quietism of saying, well, you know what, the status quo is, you know, it's good enough, it's worked in the past, why should we change anything?
Well, are you saying that there's the temptation for that to happen with the constraint?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, one of the and this is also something in, you know, that that Sowell talks about in that when we look back at people like some of the classical liberals you were talking about, Smith, Ricardo, Hume, et cetera, that or, you know, John Stuart Mill, that they were often seen, you know, they're seen now as apologists for the status quo, but in fact, they were, you know, radical for their time.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, how does a constrained vision saying like, well, you know, things were never going to be perfect, so we shouldn't really try to improve our lives?
Well, I don't think that the constrained vision argues that you stop trying. It's just an acknowledgement of limitations and an acknowledgement that there's no free lunch, that there are trade-offs. I mean, one of Sowell's most memorable sayings is there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. So you take something like the minimum wage, which we're still debating today. Yes, if you have a job making the minimum wage and they increase it, you are better off. If you keep your job, and if you keep the number of hours you are able to work under the old wage. But if you can't do that, then you'll be worse off. And so will people who won't be hired in the first place because they've been priced out of the labor market. So these are trade-offs. And the constrained vision would acknowledge that that there are trade-offs, that there's no free lunch. You just can't simply by edict raise everyone's pay and say there will be no negative consequences to doing this. It doesn't mean you're satisfied with how much people are making. It means that this isn't necessarily the best way to go about doing it, given these trade-offs, and that maybe we should try other ways to lift people's earnings.
How much? I don't want to reduce any thinker's insight into biography, but you know we've touched on this a little bit. How much of Sowell's, you know, he's bringing real stuff to economics in a way that it seems oftentimes, you know, economists, even today, but certainly in the past, just were, you know, constantly diagramming things without really mapping that onto reality. How important was his life experience in, you know, in being who he was as a thinker?
Quite important. I think he has said he turned to economics and the history of economics and the history of ideas to figure out the world around him. He talks about being a teenager and working for Western Union in Lower Manhattan. And sometimes he had some extra money and he would get on a double-decker bus to head back home in Harlem and sit on the top deck and just watch the transformation of the landscape as he headed north in Manhattan into Harlem and into the tenements where he lived. And he said, what just happened? Why did everything look so differently where I started off versus where I've ended up here? And he looked to economics to help figure that out. And one of the reasons he was so taken in by Marx is because Marx seemed to explain that. It's because you're being exploited, Tom. you're poor because other people are rich. And that explains it. The capitalists explain it. And you're part of the proletariat. You know, Marx at least offered an explanation of that, which is why he was so taken in by Marx early on. But yes, I think his upbringing played a significant role But I take a little further. Once Tom figured this stuff out for himself, then came a desire in him to share what he had learned with others, and not just other intellectuals. That spark, I believe, he got from people like Milton Friedman at Chicago, who thought it very important that intellectuals and scholars take the time to explain their discipline to non-intellectuals and non-scholars and the general public, and not just talk to one another in the faculty lounge or through academic papers and books. I think, you know, after Friedman left teaching in the 70s, that's what he did. You know, he made the Free to Choose videos. He lectured widely on college campuses and everywhere else he could. He took the time to explain his discipline to the general public. And he thought that that was very important, economic literacy. And Tom has spent a great deal of his career doing that. Even after he left teaching, most of his books are written for the general public, not for his fellow academics, although he's written those books as well. But Tom has spent a lot of time through his newspaper columns and these books explaining these ideas to people. And I think that's part of his legacy. And I think it's something, this form of public intellectualism is something I think that rubbed off from on him from people like Milton Friedman.
Yeah, he was writing for a long period of time. He was writing what, like two newspaper columns a week or something?
Yeah, he was writing for Forbes magazine, and he had a syndicated column, a newspaper column as well. Yeah,
Ken, there's a moment in the in your book where he also talks, and he's written a couple of actual memoirs and whatnot, which are really fascinating reading, but also, where he said that it was really important for him, or that not growing up in the South during, an era of de jure segregation and of, it's not like, Harlem was necessarily the promised land, but it was a galaxy away from growing up in North Carolina. And he said that, it's partly that he could be more assertive in the North in a way that, if, as a Black teenager in the South in the 40s and 50s, he might have gotten in trouble for. How does his specific kind of racial history and journey, or not journey, but, identity factor into the way that he comports himself intellectually and kind of personally?
Well, he's outspoken, he's headstrong, he's stubborn, and he said to be a Black man in the 1930s and 40s in the Deep South, that could get you seriously injured if not killed. He's not sure he would have survived. In his memoir, A Personal Odyssey, he talks about his stint in the Marines. If you did a psychological profile, the military is the last place you would put somebody like Thomas Sowell. He is not the team player. And his life in the military was pure hell from him. He's constantly challenging authorities, a whisker away from being court-martialed any number of times, getting by, barely getting out of awful situations. And so I think he's right about that, the way he's comported himself throughout his life. Things might have been a lot different had he stayed in the South, and I think he was able to be himself to a degree that he wouldn't have been able to in the South by heading north.
His work, he is a true individualist in the sense of, he is himself in all these circumstances, and it's all of our benefit that he was able to grow up in a situation where he could fully develop his talents and who he was. But he spends a lot of time talking about groups, ethnic groups, racial groups, and the ways that things play out. Can you talk about what are his essential insights into the way, what are meaningful group differences, and what are the ones that we are completely misunderstanding and often building terrible policy on?
One of his central insights is this notion that equal outcomes or racially proportionate outcomes among groups, ethnicities, races, genders, is normal. That is the norm. That is typical and what we should expect to see. And he has pointed this out, and it seems so basic, but it's something lost on many other intellectuals, let alone the general public. Equal outcomes are not the norm. Proportionate, racially proportionate or ethnically proportionate outcomes are not typical. Not typical in the U.S., not typical outside of the U.S., not typical today, not typical down through history. You don't find it. And this idea that we could hold up something that is so atypical as the norm, and where we don't see it, to then assume something nefarious is going on, is fundamentally off base. And Sowell has spent a career making this point and showing empirically why this assumption is so far off base. The other insight that he's had that I think is important, and I spent a lot of time in the book on this, is this this notion that discrimination explains these disparities that we do see, or mainly explains them. Again, Sowell has shown that, first of all, one reason it's so hard to use racism or discrimination as empirical evidence or an empirical explanation for these disparities is because racism and discrimination has been the constant down through history. So it's hard to use it as an explanation for anything. That is not to say that racism doesn't exist or that it has no impact on disparities, but to make it the main impact is something you can't just assert. You have to show empirically. And when you look at groups that have been discriminated against, one example he's used is the Japanese in America. You know, came here turn of the century in California, couldn't buy land, couldn't be citizens. World War II comes, they are rounded up en masse, put in camps. Today, Japanese Americans out-earn white Americans significantly and have for decades. And they are but one of many examples. You have the ethnic Chinese in Southeast Asia. You have the example of the Jews in any number of countries around the world. Oppressed minorities, not only rising to the point of where the majority population is in terms of education or occupational representation, but exceeding them significantly in country after country after country. So Sowell looks at these international comparisons, as well as what's going on here in the U.S., and says, you know, this tells me that discrimination does not explain as much as some people like to think it explains. I mean, at the other end, he would look at a situation like Blacks out-earning Puerto Ricans. No one would argue that Puerto Ricans have experienced more discrimination than Blacks, but if your belief is that discrimination explains why one group out-earns another group, what explains the fact that Blacks out-earn Puerto Ricans? And so again, he's using this empiricism, this logic, to go after a lot of these widely held beliefs that he believes are fundamentally flawed. And I think that is another one of his central insights throughout his scholarship.
What about, you know, he had a very strong critique of the bell curve, the Charles Murray, Richard Herrnstein book from the mid-90s, which in part argued that IQ is heritable and that that heritability essentially explains some large portion of group differences in IQ tests of Blacks scoring lower. But he pushed against that, right? He said that that's actually a very flawed theory. Can you kind of rehearse his critique of the bell curve, and what are the implications of that for either social policy or the way that we're talking about ethnic differences still to this day?
This is fascinating. Back in 1980, Sowell gave an interview to Reason magazine, and it was conducted by Manny Klausner and Tom Hazlett, the economist Tom Hazlett. This is, I think it was in December 1980 issue. And so this is, what's fascinating about this interview is it's 1980. Tom has not written so many books he is now known for, but this interview is so thorough, and you see nuggets of what is to come. He gets into the visions, unconstrained and constrained visions, when he's talking this discussion of Marxism that he goes into in the book. He gets into the race and IQ stuff as well. But at the time, the debate is over Arthur Jensen's work. And Jensen was this Harvard academic that had published a study that said intelligence is largely explained by genetics. Tom had read this back in the 70s and began his own research pushing back on it. The Murray Herbstein stuff was somewhat sympathetic to Jensen's arguments, but Tom had taken this on already because he took on Jensen. And another thing that's fascinating about that interview is Tom essentially explains the Flynn effect in this interview, but he does it years before James Flynn himself published his own findings. And the central finding here is Tom had gathered all of this IQ data, something like 50,000 IQ scores he had assessed. And the Flynn effect says that within a generation or two, there can be a significant increase in IQ scores. In fact, the size of the rise can be greater than the difference between groups in IQ, which completely undermines this idea of a genetic basis for intelligence. It doesn't mean that genetics play no role at all, but the idea that it plays the overwhelming role in IQ is really undermined by this data. And Sol was describing this in this interview, what he found, that as groups progressed, particularly socioeconomically, their IQ scores tended to rise appreciably within the future generations. And it just tells you how long Tom has been around, been talking about this stuff and been right about it in terms of his insights. Another thing he gets into in that interview is about the role of politics in helping a minority group rise, political representation. You know, this whole idea coming out of the 60s in the civil rights movement was that if we could just get more Black elected officials, you know, the rest will take care of itself socioeconomically when it comes to this. And Sol had again, this is before Sol wrote his books on his culture trilogy in the 90s. This is even before Ethnic America came out, which was his first big bestseller that got into this. This is 1980, and you see these nuggets. He had it all in his head, Nick. It was just, he hadn't written it down yet, but it was all there. And it's just fascinating to look back at one interview all those decades ago and to see little nuggets of what was to come.
As an Italian American, I am always grateful to read that, you know, my children will not be stuck with my IQ. It's, you know, and I mean, one of the things that is fascinating about his general work, his method, but then all of his books is just the vast amounts of information that he puts forth. So he talks about how, you know, Polish people and Italians were way below Blacks at certain points, and then they were higher, and they're higher than themselves, you know, were, et cetera. I mean, it's all endlessly fascinating because it complicates every time you think, okay, I've got everything covered. He can turn over a couple of more, you know, cards that then throw your unified field theory into a dispute.
One thing is also worth noting is Tom's style and his idea of what, how a scholar should behave, how intellectuals should behave, what the goal is. Despite his severe criticisms of Jensen, they were on very friendly terms and continued a correspondence throughout Jensen's life. When Jensen found something that spoke to some of Sol's points, he would send it to Tom. Tom would read it. They had conversations about these things. He wasn't into name calling. He wasn't, and these weren't ad hominem attacks that Tom was making on people he disagreed with. And similar with Charles Murray. I interviewed Charles Murray, who had nothing but praise for Sol, even though Sol was quite critical of that book. And I think it also speaks to Tom's intellectual independence and his maverick nature. Even someone who, you know, ideologically, politically, he is mostly in agreement with when it comes to someone like Murray, he nevertheless did not hesitate to criticize Murray's scholarship when he thought it was warranted. And I think that is something we don't see enough of today, frankly.
You know, kind of in a related way, in the book, you talk a fair amount about his standing among Black intellectuals or writers and other public figures who disagree with him. And you talk to Gerald Early at Washington University and a couple of other people. You know, and he did work with people like Orlando Patterson and whatnot. I mean, kind of intellectual, Black intellectuals, African-American intellectuals who you assume are so far in the left, they would have nothing good to say about somebody like Sowell. Can you talk about how he is either an inspiration or a challenge, or, you know, he's meaningful to, you know, Black intellectuals who, you know, may not agree with him on very much?
Some, Nick, but they're rare. Yeah. I think by and large, the Black intellectual left, and by that I'm talking about not only academics, but media elites and so forth, have largely, to use today's phrasing, canceled Thomas Sowell. He has been someone who is determined to be sort of what they've done to Clarence Thomas in a way. He's someone who is not to be listened to when it comes to these issues of race and inequality. He's outside, he's beyond the pale. He's outside the mainstream. And I, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to do the documentary and write the book is because I don't think Tom has received his due. In the great pantheon of Black thinkers out there, where you mentioned people like Henry Louis Gates and William Julius Wilson, and today you throw in names like Michelle Alexander or Ta-Nehisi Coates or Imam Kendi and so forth. I think Tom's scholarship has not only been much broader, but much deeper and much more rigorous than those guys. I think he's written circles around them. And I think with the help of the media, he's somehow been sidelined. It's interesting. One of the questions, and I mentioned this in the book, that Tom is always asked in interviews, or frequently asked, I should say, is, you know, how does it feel to hold views that are also held by so few fellow Blacks, and you know, to be sort of out of step with most Black people? And Tom inevitably needs to correct them and say, no. You mean I'm out of step with Black intellectuals and elites? He says, but Black intellectual elites are no more representative of Black people than white intellectual elites are representative of white people. And he's right about that. When you go into his writings, whether he's, you know, talking about affirmative action or busing or many of these issues, he is very much in step with the Black rank and file on these issues. And the problem is that the media has bought into this belief that the NAACP's out there and the urban leagues out there and these Black intellectuals speak for most Black people, when in fact they don't. There is a chasm there that has been growing for decades. Yet when the media goes and wants Black opinion on something, they're turning to an Al Sharpton and so forth, when in fact those people do not really represent. This whole debate over policing, and whether we should defund the police, or whether the biggest problem in these communities is the policing. When you go and talk to people who live in these communities, that is nonsense. Yet it is repeated daily by Black elites and the media. And there again, you see this large gap between Black elite opinion and the opinion of the Black rank and file. And that's something that I think Tom has been dealing with for decades.
In both the documentary and the book, you are, you know, incredibly favorably disposed towards Sowell. You champion his work, his life, et cetera. What are the things that you disagree with him about, or where do you think he has gotten something wrong?
Where do I disagree with Tom? He's probably, personality-wise, I think he's a little rough around the edges. There are some stories. He doesn't suffer fools, let's put it that way, and he can be a little brusque. At the same time, I also found story after story of his great generosity in dealing with former students and dealing with colleagues, helping people and so forth. But he can be a little brusque, I think. Some of the other stories point out. Policy-wise, there isn't a lot of disagreement. Mm-hmm. I think I would quibble with some of his views on immigration. But even there, I think there's not much disagreement. I mean, one of the issues that Sowell has taken issue with in terms of libertarians in immigration, for example, is this view that that there is such a thing as a typical immigrant. And Sowell likes to point out that there is no such thing as a typical immigrant. And the type of immigrant matters, and why they're coming matters, and are the right incentives in place, the right infrastructure and the place that that's receiving them, and so forth. All of that matters. And unless you're going to talk about it in that context, you can't really just talk about immigrants per se or immigration as such. And he is sort of quibbled with folks who like to do that. I take his point. I think I would still favor more open immigration policies than he would, but I take his point.
He also, at various places, I mean, he's defined himself or described himself as kind of libertarian, but then immediately will say, but I disagree with him about a variety of things, including military stuff. In one book in the early 80s, he was claiming against evidence that military spending was going down. At other places, he's against nation building because he understands, for the reasons it's hard to build, you know, society in America. You're that much more at a handicap when you're trying to build a society somewhere that you don't even know anything about. Yet he seems to be very pro-military. What is, you know, what's his sense of foreign policy, or what's the role that the military plays for him in his world?
I think that would come out of the constrained vision that he has, that it's a necessary institution, that because of the world as it exists, we can hope that there's no need for more military spending. We can hope that the bad guys will change their behavior and stop trying to kill us or take over the world, but it's unlikely to happen. And so it is one of those things we need. It's an institution that is necessary. And I think it would come out of that constrained vision, his views on the military. I do think he does lean quite a bit libertarian. I mean, I don't think he's as libertarian as someone like Walter Williams was, for example. But I do think he certainly leans in that direction. But he has been critical of libertarians on some issues, immigration, defense spending, and as well as critical of the neocons when it comes to things like nation building, like you mentioned. So it can be a little tough to label at times. Yeah.
Where was he on Donald Trump as a figure or as a force?
That's interesting. I was just reading. He I don't know if you recall the symposium that National Review put together in early 2016. Tom contributed to that symposium. And against Donald Trump, he was strongly against him. He later, though, he told me that he voted for him over Hillary Clinton. I think he argued that it was more of a vote against Hillary than a vote for Trump. But what's interesting is that Tom gave up his column in 2016. He retired the column, although he's continued to write books. He retired the column, so he hasn't done a whole bunch of column writing in the Trump years. But I have no doubt that that Sol would have been, had he been writing that column, stuck to his own principles, whether it was in favor of free trade, issues like that. I don't think that that Sol would have bent in any direction. He would have pointed out where he thought the president was wrong, based on, you know, what he's done with past presidents throughout his career. When he thought Ronald Reagan was wrong about something, or George W. Bush was wrong about something, he did not hesitate to say so. He's criticized Clarence Thomas's rulings, even though they're friends. So Tom doesn't pull his punches, and I don't think he would have done that with Donald Trump.
One of the details in your book is that he pulled a manuscript from a publisher who was insisting that he write AD 300 rather than like 300 AD. This is a guy who obviously is, you know, he's very particular in his positions.
So. Yeah, for many years I was on the staff of the Wall Street Journal. I still write a column for them, but I'm no longer on the staff. And I can tell you that, Sol would write for the paper, not infrequently. And he was one of these authors where you could not touch the copy when it came in, when he wrote a piece. There are very few. I mean, I less than a handful.
Well, there's a lot of people who say that.
Less than a handful that can get away with that, at least at the Wall Street Journal. And Tom was one of them. And it's the same with the publishers. I interviewed some of editors at publishing houses who said the same thing. His books come in written. In fact, Tom doesn't write book proposals. He writes the book, gives it to his agent, and says, let me know when you found someone who's interested in publishing this. But there are very few authors can get away with making a living doing that. But Tom was one of them.
What, you were an English major, were you not?
Yes, I was.
Yes. So is Thomas Sowell right about English majors and other people who play around in the humanities?
Right in what way? I mean, what's
that he seems to, you know, I guess for me, and this is not from his books, it's more from the columns, that there's a, you know, a kind of a curmudgeonly element to him. And he dismisses the humanities in higher education in a kind of brusque way that I find off-putting, given that so many of the people I know, including myself, you know, spend time learning, you know, non-social science or non-research science, and we've come out okay. We, you know, we're productive members of society, and some of us are among the better thinkers of our ilk.
I don't know that it's a categorical dismissal to that extent. I think Tom has little patience for people sounding off on topics they, in his view, haven't thought through. And when they don't know what they're talking about. And Tom is very good at punching holes in people's arguments. And so perhaps a disproportionate number of English majors have tried to argue with him. And that has rubbed him the wrong way. He's very hard on sociologists as well. It's not just English.
And education professors and whatnot. Yes. Well, could you talk a little bit about your what kind of personal inspiration or you know that do you draw from someone like Thomas Sowell?
Well, I first learned about Tom when I was in college in the early 1990s, and I was working on the school paper and having a conversation with some of my colleagues one day about affirmative action. And someone said, Jason, you sound like Tom Sowell. And I said, who's that? And the person wrote down the title of one of Tom's books, Civil Rights, Rhetoric versus Reality. And I went to the library that afternoon, checked it out and read it in one sitting that evening, and was just blown away. Went back to the school library the next day and checked out the entire Tom Sowell collection, and have been hooked ever since. I first met him working at the Wall Street Journal in the mid-90s. He would come through New York on book tours and meet with various editorial boards.
Which meant he was there at least once a year, right, for about 15 years.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I first got to meet him in the mid-90s, and then in the mid-2000s, I went out to the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and did a profile of him for the paper, and that's when we struck up an acquaintance that has endured. And when the makers of the documentary found out I was working on this biography, they approached me and said, would you have any interest in narrating this for us and coming up with some people to interview and doing some of the interviews? And I said, sure, I'd be delighted to. So that's how I got involved with that. Personally, however, Sowell has had a huge impact on my own thinking. I mean, even if I was already leaning in that direction before I discovered him, his ability to again to speak to non-intellectuals, to lay it out, to take and to draw from so many disciplines. One of the quotes I have in the book is from the writer Mark Halperin, who calls Trump one of the great trespassers in intellectual life. That he draws from sociology, from history, from economics, from philosophy, and which is not always appreciated by his fellow intellectuals. The historian who says, that's not how we look at this. You know, Tom brings this economic empiricism to anything he's writing about. That's something that I've greatly appreciated. And then the need to be a critical thinker in the way that he has, and to question even widely held beliefs that people just assume to be true because they've been repeated for so long. Tom says, no, not so quick. You know, everything needs to be tested empirically. And so he's been a great inspiration to me. And I'm sure many, many other readers. I often say that he left teaching a long time ago, but has continued essentially through those columns and through those books for the general public.
What is your sense of, I think it was in your book, which one of the great flourishes of the book is that, you know, oftentimes your chapters start out or the discussions range into, you know, kind of adjacent or forgotten history of different things, which makes it really interesting to read. You, I believe, talked about George Schuyler, who was a very well-regarded Black kind of public intellectual, for lack of a better word, newspaper man who had been huge and then just kind of disappeared. Do you worry about that for Tom Sowell? He does not have, he reminds me of somebody who I think we both know through a connection at University of Buffalo, somebody like Leslie Fiedler, a great literary critic who everybody who comes into contact, who came into contact with him would be like, okay, this guy is a genius, incredible, but he chose not to develop a school of, you know, mini-me's or clones that would go out and perpetuate and pump up his reputation. Sowell is very much like that. He, you know, and it's partly because liberal intellectuals, generally liberal Black or left-wing Black intellectuals, don't even want to engage him. Do you worry that his reputation and his work won't survive into the future?
A little bit, but I think that he has written in such a wide number of fields and made an impact in such a wide number of fields that even if people in this discipline or that discipline want to try and dismiss him, he'll be remembered elsewhere, which is not the case with Schuyler, who obviously wasn't as prolific either, but was largely a race man. And mm-hmm. Sowell has an entire oeuvre outside of in fact, most of Tom's books are not on racial themes. His best
Yeah, we did not talk about his books about late talking children, which
his
are
his best-selling
phenomenal.
Book is Basic Economics, mm-hmm. which is basically an economics textbook with no graphs and charts and equations. And he's
I like it already. The English major in me is I can get that.
But I think that the fear and I get into this in the book in an interview with Steven Pinker and some other intellectuals. Interesting, they're the intellectuals who came to Tom not through his writings on race, but on his writings on other topics, like Pinker did, who came to Tom through his writings on human nature, who worry that Tom's more polemic writings on race will overshadow the others and that he will not be as appreciated for the scholar that he is because he said so many unpopular things, politically incorrect things when it comes to writing on race and ethnicity and culture. And that is their concern, that because they don't think that's really where Sowell has made his mark as an intellectual. I somewhat disagree with that, not in their assessment of how he might be remembered, but you know, for many of them, they would rather he had not done this stuff on race. I that would have been a huge mistake, I think, from my perspective. And Tom knew this. He has often said that he wrote about these racial topics almost out of a sense of duty, because there were things that needed to be said that too few others were willing to say. And I'm so glad he did his duty. I think we are so much better off for having this body of work out there to draw on that is still so relevant today. If he had spent his entire career writing about intellectual history and Jean-Baptiste Say and the classical liberals, I'm sure he'd still be remembered as a great scholar, but I am so glad he decided to take the punches he's taken over this other stuff on race and ethnicity and culture, because I think for some of us, That's equally important.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you so much, Jason Riley, for talking to Reason about Thomas Sowell and about the documentary that you narrate about him, which is online at the Free to Choose Network, as well as your forthcoming book, Maverick, a biography of Thomas Sowell.
Thank you.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.